Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's April 2nd, 2017, and welcome to episode 150 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and trying to squeeze every drop we can out of Roman numerals. My name's Earl Evans, and I'm a regular on this podcast, and I'm also joined by some of the other regulars in the Retro Computer Roundtable community. We'll start with Jack. How are you doing today, Jack?
Hi, Earl. I'm doing pretty good. Hanging out over here in Sweden where it's starting to turn into spring, but I guess it's probably just going to snow again pretty soon anyway.
Really?
Yeah, probably wow. A little bit. It snowed twice this past week.
Huh.
Well, just light dusting and then it melts away, but still something.
You're up there in the latitude with an attitude. So.
Yes, mm-hmm. Indeed.
So other places that it snows include Boston, Massachusetts, where we will find our favorite collector of all things retro and dusty, Paul Hagstrom.
Hello, everybody. Yes, it did actually snow here a couple days ago, too, which is ridiculous. But today it's like 50, so it's interesting, I suppose.
Huh. Well, Portland had more than its typical share of snow this year, but we're well out of the snow season, at least here in the normal altitudes. We might still be getting some snow up on Mount Hood. I don't know. I'd have to check that out. It's a favorite skiing place around here, and a rather beautiful mountain, if I do say so myself. I didn't invent it, but so down where the weather might be starting towards being cooler. Now, how are you, Michael?
Well, pretty good. Yes, it's in the autumn here. I'll translate fall. On the last episode, I think I mentioned how we were just getting lots and lots of rain and things were going bad. Less than 24 hours after recording that show, I got flooded.
Oh, no.
Oh.
Yeah, it was just the garage and the workshop. The important thing is the 8-bit bunker was not affected by the deluge, and so all my treasures and books and things are fine, but soggy boxes and everything upstairs in the garage. So that was not a fun night.
Yikes.
Pushing the water out and mopping up. But and guess what? It's still raining.
Oh no.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it's probably not only not a fun night, but not a fun, subsequent weeks.
Yeah, well, fortunately it was clean water, so it wasn't silty and muddy, so yeah. I haven't had to do the worst type of cleaning up. It was, as I say, it was basically anything that was on the floor had a couple of inches of water run through. Most of it ran away, but the rest had to be swept out and then stuff picked up and... Yeah, so you get a bit complacent after a while. You stop putting things up on shelves or sitting on things to keep them off the floor. So maybe my complacency about storage will not be so complacent for a while.
Yeah, all the way up until like the week before the next flood.
Yeah, that's right. So gotta keep those drains and everything clear. That was I thought I was on top of it, but it would seem not. So. Soggy bottoms here.
Hmm. Well, It sounds like you had to do some cleaning, and that's actually a good segue into the host topic for this episode. We were going to talk about cleaning your retro computers, or maybe the peripherals for your retro computers, and what are some of the challenges, what are some of the techniques that you use, what are some of the things that you want to clean in your retro collection, but you're not quite sure how you're going to go about it. Michael, since you had the flood, I'm kind of feeling some empathy for you here, so I think I'm going to let you go first.
Okay. Well, as I said, fortunately, I didn't have any last-minute cleaning to do because of that, but one machine jumps to mind. It's right to me on the cusp of retro. It was I picked up off eBay a G5 Power Mac. I was really just after it for parts for another machine that I was building. But when I got it home, I opened it up because the seller told me that when they last turned it on, it had made a strange smell and they turned it off. Now, they didn't say how far they got into it, but it looks like someone had managed to spill a whole can of Coca-Cola inside the machine or some other fizzy drink. So it just had that lovely, tacky gunge all over it. And of course, they'd been using the computer. They had it sitting on the floor underneath their desk. So not only was it nice and sticky, it had been now liberally dust bunnied with tacky bunnies inside. And I was thinking, this is really going to be more than worth the $25 that I paid for this. And I'm just going to strip it down and just take the case. So just took it all apart, and I thought, I'll just try cleaning it all down. So just wiped it down, just cleaned it with distilled water and wipes, and then just sat the motherboard out literally to dry, and cleaned out, wiped out everything else, and put it all back together, and lo and behold, it was working perfectly. So it wasn't such a bad $25 investment after all, but Coca-Cola and computers just don't mix.
Pepsi syndrome.
Yeah. But on retro machines, my cleaning, I try to limit that to just dusting them out, a little bit of compressed air to blow out the dust bunnies that are caught up in the corner, just a general wipe down. I'm not a retro brighter. I let my machines age disgracefully like their owner. I'm all for the patina of the years that these machines have collected. And actually, I find it quite attractive. You have all these peripherals, and once upon a time, they might have all looked the same color for each of your machines, but each manufacturer has used a slightly different plastic, and they may have all started out looking the same color, but they certainly don't now. So I kind of quite like that mismatched range of different patinas of Apple Platinum that's gone beige, or any of my other machines that started off white or cream, and they've changed to different shades. I quite enjoy it. Hmm. Yeah, I'm just a basic. I even if there's permanent marker on it, I'm very hesitant to remove that because I feel that it's part of the character the machine has collected. So I don't really want to abrade the surface of the cabinet or you can tell there's writing there because that's a nice bright shiny patch. So I'm more of a dust it and wipe it down kind of guy.
Makes sense. It you always do run the risk of damaging the surface of, well, I guess, anything when you're trying to clean off something that is really, really stuck or burned on there like permanent marker. So depending on what it looks like, I'm kind of with you. I'd almost rather leave it than try to clean it off and wind up destroying the surface texture.
Yeah, because you can always pick, hopefully you can always pick up another case from somewhere else in your collection. So, you know, if you can get a better case and you got better working innards in the original, then yeah, I'll swap. I've done that with some of my old HD20 floppy drive connected hard drives for my early Mac. I had one which was working but had a broken case, and another one which the case was in beautiful condition, a little bit patinaed. So, yeah, that was a very simple transplant, but that's my normal philosophy, so that if something is beyond cleaning or horribly damaged, I just do a replacement.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, Jack, what do you have in terms of cleaning? Do you have horror stories? Do you have awesome success stories? Do you have lots of stuff that you wish was clean and you just kind of look at it and hope time will take care of it? Or?
Well, I have kind of a mix of things. So two things came to mind when we started talking about this. One is not really about a vintage or retro computer at all. It may be by this time. It's this is just and it related to Michael's story about spillage. It was a computer that I had that was a laptop that belonged to my employer some number of years ago. I'll be imprecise so I don't incriminate myself. It was some employer in the past. And as I was on my way leaving this job, I only had a few days left. I had my laptop at home, and somebody who I won't name by name, but it is the person I'm married to, spilled a whole glass of milk right into the keyboard, just like straight down into the thing. And I immediately it was plugged in. I unplugged it. I popped the battery off the bottom. This was an older MacBook, some model, right? That had a battery easily reachable on the bottom. And then I realized, okay, I had no screwdriver that could open this. It required a torque screwdriver, and I didn't have any. And it was in the evening, and the stores were closed. So, okay, I figured, okay, all I can do is let it sit, and tomorrow I'll buy the screwdriver so I can open this thing and see what happened. And when I opened it up, it was amazing because the milk had formed sort of a cake on the motherboard. Like the entire underside of the motherboard was like, it was like cake. It smelled like cake too. it had poured in there and immediately burned solid. The way if you scorch milk in a frying pan or in a pan on the stove. So I don't know what I used. I used something to just brush it all off. I found something that was hard enough to brush off the stuff without being hard enough to scrape away the underside of the motherboard. And I put it back together and turned it on, and it worked, and I left it because I was leaving this job. So I wondered afterwards whatever happened to that computer later, whoever took it after me, if they had a funny smell in their computer, which they probably did.
Or maybe a yummy smell like cake. Yeah, like wow, eternal cake.
This computer is fantastic. It always smells like cake. Could be. And the other thing that I was thinking of is just like the amount of dirt that we're carrying around in these old machines and the distances this travels and how long we hang on to them. I very recently opened up an Atari 2600 video game because I was installing a mod in there. And this is a machine that I bought from a neighbor in Minneapolis 20 plus years ago. This was a neighbor who, a couple who really did not have their act together. Like they were people who were always in borderline and being evicted. And like they had, I don't know, they had dogs living in their apartment who never left the apartment, which is bad when you have dogs. They should go outside sometimes, honestly. Their dogs did not. Anyway, so at one point, one of them came down and knocked on my door and said, "Hey, I've got an old video game. Do you want to buy it?" And I was like, "What is it?" And they're like, "Oh, it's an Atari." And they showed me, and I was like, "Sure." And so I bought the console and all of their cartridges for I don't know how much. So I've had it for many, many years, and I cleaned it off somewhat when I bought it. I kind of wiped it down, and then about just a year or two ago, I pulled it out of the box that I had, and I was like, "Gosh, this needs a little better cleaning." And so I scrubbed it down more properly so that everything that was visible on the outside was pretty much squeaky clean. And then today when I opened it up, I was greeted by this level, this layer of filth. And I was like, wow, this is probably old dog hair from that neighbor couple that I've carried with me to Sweden, and I've been storing it for 20 years. It's incredible. It's like I'm able to establish the provenance of the filth in my equipment. It's interesting.
And who knows, you might have introduced an invasive species into your ecosystem.
Great.
Wonderful. Who knows what sort of spores have laid dormant in there for 20 years, and I've now awakened it. So, but otherwise, I also, the older machines that I have, I sort of let them be old as they are. I try and keep things clean, but I've never done any retro brighting or anything like that. It looks interesting. It also looks like it probably takes a lot of time for something that is not going to do much for me. Like, I'm fine with things looking old. That's fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it, in a sense, it can be part of their charm.
Right.
Well, Paul, what about you?
Yeah.
Tell us your cleaning stories.
Yeah, I guess one thing I was going to say about, I also have not tried retrobrighting, though. A few years ago, I bought the chemicals that are needed and a little UV light and then set them aside for later. But I'm not sure I want to go down the retrobrighting path just because of the volume involved. But the other thing, I think I do agree that I kind of like the yellow that things turn and stuff like that, except for the ones where they were like sitting in the sun with a cord on them. Or, you know, like in the shadow or something, so that there's like a tan line. Those.
Or stickers.
Right.
If you had a sticker on something and you take the sticker off, I had a Mac SE like that, where when I took the sticker off, that area had not yellowed over time. So it was just this kind of weird, bright rectangle in the middle of a otherwise fairly yellowed Macintosh.
Right. And those are the things I think I might actually start feeling like this looks ugly enough. I might just see if I can smooth it out by retrobrighting it. But so far I haven't tried any of these things. I've just got the, you know, the.
Or we could just go and totally cover it up with plastic adhesive contact.
Mm-hmm. So when I went back, you know, and I sort of was starting out this whole project, I had my parents ship me the Apple II Plus clone that I used as a kid. This was the Apple II Plus that we had as a family. We had a II Plus that they got for Christmas for the family, which I then used like 92% of the time. And eventually then I, you know, that 8% I was still fighting for. So eventually I just got my own clone. But the, and I have both of these machines here now, but the Apple II Plus, the actual one, when I got it here, there was some, I don't know what it was, I'm not sure I actually want to know what it was, I kind of think it might have been like a foot of a disk drive or something that had fallen in and then melted, as they do, but there was this terrible, like, blop of goop, like, on the motherboard that was clearly not supposed to be there, and I didn't really want to, like, turn it on while that was there, so I puzzled over this for a while, and of course it had kind of seeped underneath a socket, you know, so, like, I could take the chip out of the socket and clean underneath it, but there's still goop. So I eventually did take it to a shower and just, like, you know, like, diligently took out all the chips, you know, all the socketed chips were out, and I think actually pretty much everything is socketed on the Apple II, and so I laid them all out and sent it through the shower and let it dry. I put it on a, like, above a dehumidifier, so it was just sort of attempting to get it to dry as quickly as possible. Blew out the space under the sockets as I could. And then I think actually as I was putting it back together, I forget exactly what caused me. Oh, maybe this was actually when I was taking it apart. I was like trying to pry up the chips and I got too eager and quick. And so I wound up prying up part of a socket instead. So I don't know if it works. That was 2012, but it really looks nice when it comes out of the shower. That's actually what I was thinking. That's what the thought that led me down this path is, they look beautiful. So, I've never tried the dishwasher. I know people do that. And my general thought about that is that the people who say, oh, just use the dishwasher, are people who, like, I'm not sure that they have expertise in this. They've just done it, and you know, as far as they know, nothing's gone wrong. But, you know, I took that from that, at least, that water is not inherently damaging, as long as you can kind of get it out of there quickly enough. But mostly what I've heard from people say is that you want to take out all the chips you can. You want to try to, you know, you don't want stuff to, you don't want water to kind of like dry out and leave whatever minerals were in it behind, making contacts that aren't supposed to be made if you can. I've tried doing some cleaning with the, like, you know, rubbing alcohol, and I forget what I've got, you know, it's 90 something percent, but even that always seems to leave kind of like a little bit of a white film, which I don't enjoy. So I don't know. I feel like I kind of want to learn a little bit more about how to do this right. But yeah, I mean, apart from that, you know, mostly I've just Windexed down the cases. I have a little bottle of Goo Gone, which I will sometimes use to try to get sticker residue out, and that has worked pretty well. But I think most of my cleaning is still for the future.
Well, I can sympathize on the sticker thing. Old stickers are evil. I think I tweeted about that a little while ago. They're just demonic, you know. I've tried a few different approaches at getting rid of them, including Goo Gone. I've tried using isopropyl at the highest, whatever, 99.9 or, you know, basically nearly pure isopropyl alcohol. And that actually does pretty well. It's just that it takes a lot of work, takes a lot of elbow grease. Another thing that people have mentioned is this type of pad, this cleaning pad called the Magic Eraser, I think it is.
Yeah, that works really well, actually.
Yeah, I've seen some cases that had sticker residue or other things like that cleaned off with that Magic Eraser, and it didn't kill the texture of the case, but it did get the stuff off there. So I got to get me some of that, because I've got to, you know, I got a lot more cleaning to do. I actually went on a cleaning binge a little while ago. I cleaned quite a few retro computers, and I've been refurbishing these hard disk removable packs for the DEC PDP-11. The specific drive is called an RLO2, and these are giant disk packs, 14-inch disk packs, and they came to me in quite a variety of conditions. Some looked fairly pristine, and others really had the I've been left out in the bed of a pickup truck for years kind of look to them. So cleaning that, and with stickers all over the place in varying states. You know, some of the stickers were easy to get off, but some others just left this ugly crust that I struggle to get off of here. And Goo Gone, I find, is okay, but it has such a strong orange citrus smell that you really need to take the cleaning pad or the paper towel or whatever you used with the Goo Gone and get that into a trash can that gets emptied often. Because I had some of it in the gadget room here at home for a couple of days, and the smell did not diminish. And I had to launch that. So I've never retrobrighted either, and I'm not sure that I would want to, except for a couple of very specific conditions. The keyboard on my Commodore SX64, that's that portable Commodore 64, most of the keys look pretty good, aside from having some of the Petsky graphics scrubbed off of them a bit. But the space bar has turned an awful shade of yellow, just this cute kind of yellow. In contrast with the white and black keys, it looks horrible. And it would be nice to take those keys off of the keyboard, retrobrite them so that they come to a uniform color, and then put the keyboard back together. I think that is one case where I'd be willing to do the retrobrite thing. Oh, so cleaning inside the retro computers, that was interesting. I had an Apple IIe Platinum, an IBM PS2 Model 30, and a Commodore PET. And I bought some anti-static brushes off of Amazon, and I started before I did any of the real working computers, I set out with a broken circuit board that I had that was still of the era. It's a DEC circuit board, but broken from late 70s, early 80s. I decided I'm going to go at this with the brushes and with the isopropyl and see what happens. So I did that, and nothing bad happened. And since it's this super pure alcohol, it didn't leave the residue that you were talking about, Paul. It it dried pretty cleanly. So then I set about to some of these real circuit boards, and all three of them really needed some help. I think the worst of the three was the PS2 Model 30. Somehow it had just gotten crusted and dusty, and the compressed air can didn't even touch it. It just snickered as I used the compressed air can on it. So I went with the brushes and the alcohol, and it cleaned up pretty nicely. And I'm told, again, since this alcohol dries completely and quickly and is non-conductive, that it doesn't really pose much of a risk. That's my experience. It worked for me. Here is one thing that I will say, though. If you use the alcohol and a brush and you're trying to clean it off, one downside is you might just move the dust around. And when it dries, it'll dry again, dusty, kind of in clumps. And I'm not exactly sure how to deal with that. I've heard of the dishwasher trick too. And in fact, a couple of the people on the classic computer mailing list that were talking about the dishwasher trick are actually very old hands in classic computing and have circuit boards that can be worth more than the ones that I'm dealing with. And they swear by the dishwasher trick. Here's my thing. I think we might have talked about this on the RCR at one point. Those old circuit boards weren't made with the most human-friendly of materials.
Right.
They had lead and they had other chemical stuff. And I'm not sure that I want to put that in my dishwasher or bake off the water from that in my oven when I'm then going to use my dishwasher and my oven to prepare the food that my family is eating. I don't know. Am I crazy for being a little reluctant like that?
But you will be if you do this with mercury poisoning.
Yeah, get a little mercury, a little lead, you know. Never hurt anybody, right? So those are my stories on cleaning. I have, you know, taken the cleaning materials to some things, and I'm satisfied with the results, but I'm not perfectly satisfied, and I'd like to learn how to do it better.
Yeah, I was going to say, too, just a couple of comments on that. So the Magic Eraser is some kind of micro-abrasive, so it is still abrasive, and you can destroy the surface, but if you're sort of careful with it, it seems to do a pretty good job without actually sanding it down. And the other thing, too, is that Charles Mangan has a video podcast he calls How To, and he had at one point suggested using sunscreen. Apparently that he sort of went through this for removing things like marker. And he tried alcohol and he tried a couple other things and then he tried sunscreen and you know, it still takes some work, but it actually apparently did a pretty good job. So How To podcast episode 6, cleaning vintage plastic parts.
Oh,
anyway. Excellent. I haven't tried that since then. But
sunscreen,
yeah.
Huh? Interesting.
So he says, in this episode, I explain how to remove marker, stickers, and other grime from vintage plastic parts. Also, why my Apple II collection smells like the beach.
Very good. I'm getting a tan.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think we've cleaned this one to death. So I'm going to move on to items of interest and news, and I'm going to start with Jack.
But first... there is some feedback that we could possibly talk
about.
Oh,
wait. Yes. Oh, feedback. Did I skipped right over that. What a lousy host I am. Yeah, Paul, tell us about the feedback.
I can talk a little bit about that. I can try to go quickly. But we had a couple things I wanted to note. So Angela wrote to point out a auction on shopgoodwill.com. The auction is closed. It closed at $77, but the computer itself is a weird thing that I had never seen before. I don't know what to make of it. It is a computer called Your Computer, and it looks like a couple of different things. It's a clone of something. I don't actually know what. On the box, it says Z80A CPU, expandable to 16K or 32K RAM. If I had to guess, I think it would be probably something like a ZX80 clone, like a Timex Sinclair or a Sinclair ZX80 or ZX81 or something. That's probably what it is. It doesn't quite look like one. It has actually like little spongy keys. But anyway, impossible, absolutely impossible to find anything about this on the web, because how do you search for it? So that's why I wanted to bring it up here, because no one's ever going to see this again. Unless you have. So if anyone out there listening to this has a your computer, a Sinclair clone, let us know. This one, you know, it seemed to come actually, it has little green keys, and it comes with a what appears to be a 16K RAM expander pack, which is why I think it's a ZX80 clone. Anyone seen one of these before? I know the answer.
Definitely not.
No, I have not.
No,
no. I saw the email when it came in and looked around a little bit, and no, it's unique.
It's unsearchable.
It's probably terrible. I mean, it's probably like a super cheap. I mean, to the extent you can have a cheap knockoff of a cheap ZX80.
But it's your computer.
That's right.
Very personal.
I was looking at the ports in the back. It does have both like a TV, like I guess an RF port, and a monitor port, like composite, which is nice for something that is probably as dirt cheap as this was. Mm-hmm. But also, even more interesting, it has what I guess are 1/8-inch jacks for ear and for mic.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't imagine what you could do with a microphone with this device. It can't have been sampling anything. I just wonder what... I'm baffled.
I think it's just for saving programs on cassette.
Okay, sure. That makes sense.
Though this also has a joystick port, which that is unusual for a machine of this sort. So, I mean, like, I think you can use joysticks on a ZX80 or a Timex Sinclair 1000, but it's an add-on thing, I'm pretty sure. So maybe this actually is pretty cool. Unfortunately, I didn't bid. It went for $77, so 8 people bid on it. So it was not people noticed it. But anyway. Yeah, I thought that was. I'm glad that was brought to our attention, because it's kind of interesting. Mike wrote to. So last time we had talked a little bit about. I think Michael, you had been talking about using DOSBox to go kind of like get people started on with like things that you need, legacy stuff that you need to support and that kind of stuff.
Yep, that's right.
So Mike wrote in to point out VDOS as an alternative, and he said he had been using that to get people running legacy Fox Pro applications. And actually, maybe I'll stop talking and leave this to you others here, because I think the conversation continued a little bit over the email.
Well, I actually sent him a reply to let him know I was using something called VDOS Plus, which was derived from VDOS, and this is a DOS emulator that is more focused on business applications and character applications than it is focused on gaming. DOSBox has a pretty pronounced gaming focus and really does well at that. Not as friendly when you're talking about running things like development tools or old line of business applications like you might see in Fox Pro or Clipper or that. And one of the neat things about VDOS Plus, and maybe in VDOS, I don't know, is that it enables the use of TrueType fonts with actual scaling. So whatever monitor resolution you're running on, the applications look really nice. The fonts are very nicely rendered. And I found that to be fairly compelling. So I just wanted to let him know that. He was happy to hear about that and might actually look into it. And it sounded like some other folks did have line of business applications, legacy things that they'd encountered as well that a DOS emulator like this would be helpful for. And I was just surprised that stuff that was written in the 80s and 90s is still in use. But like I said in the email reply, I guess if it's not broke, don't fix it, it's a thing.
I'm sure that's why a lot of, why we still need people who know COBOL now. I mean, it's one thing to say we really could, we could do this so much better on a new computer, but it doesn't write itself.
Right.
And Michael, you had, I guess, suggested PCM.
Yeah, Mike was also looking for a solution to run 16-bit compiled Windows 3.1.1 applications. So that's Yeah, I use DOSBox to install Windows 3.1.1, and you know it's not just to play Civilizations 2. That I must admit is the main reason, but I've got other editors and utilities that run under Windows 3.1.1, so I'm quite happy with running Windows 3.1.1 under DOSBox. At least that gives you that separate environment. And you know, the main thing I like about it is that the file system is the file system of your computer. So if you want to push a file into where Windows 3.1.1 or DOS is going to pick it up, you just copy the file in to the appropriate location of, let's just say you're going to put it in your C drive temp. You just copy it to there. So that's pretty good because it allows me to push in what I'm working on. I can get the old editors that I'm using to manipulate the bits and whatnot. And when I save the file, I can then just go in and just literally copy that file out and push it across the network to the machine that I need to use it on. Another emulator, virtualizer, whatever I've seen but I haven't had the chance to use is PCM, PCMEmulator.co.uk.
That's a PCEM.
Yeah, PCEM. So that's more along the lines of a hardware emulator. So I'm hoping that to give that a go and then sort of put a version of DOS on top of that and see how far I can push Windows 3.1.1 because there are features and functionality in 3.1.1 that just don't run under DOSBox, but they haven't been an issue for me. But I thought I'd give PCEM a go just to sort of have a look to see if it's another avenue that I can use for retro commercial software. So
yeah, I didn't just to clarify, I wasn't correcting your pronunciation so much as I was realizing that no one listening would understand how you spelled that. But I assume they call it PCM also.
Well, let's put it in the show notes.
Okay. Already done.
Excellent. That way it gets around my accent and my spelling of URLs.
Okay, let's see. So the last bit of feedback that I wanted to mention was that Paulo wrote in. So he was the one who wrote did the translation of the article, the Portuguese article on the CP500 that we talked about last time. This is a TRS-80 clone that was built by one of the designers of the Portuguese. You know, the machine itself. So you can refer back to episode 149 for that. So first of all, Paulo wrote in to say thanks for mentioning the Vintage is the New Old site that the translation appeared on. And here we are mentioning it again. So this is a cycle that will never end. But he wanted to clarify when we were talking about the CP500 that It has little, so it's a, like a, I don't know what, scale, a third scale or something. It's a small scale model that has a Raspberry Pi 3 inside of it. And it has these little floppy drives. And when I was talking about it before, I was just sort of speculating that they just make noise, you know, in a pleasing way. But in fact, actually, the drives accept little floppy disks. And the little disks have holes punched in them that are a binary code that tells the emulator what image to load off the SD card. So they actually do essentially work, which is totally fantastic.
So cool.
So anyway, the machine itself is running modified SDL TERS on Raspberry Pi 3. Stilters? I wonder what they call that. SDL TRS maybe. Which will come back. I think this will come back later too in the news. So that's it. Thanks, everybody, for writing, though.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you, Paul, for helping me not hand over the mic prematurely before we got to the feedback. At this point, though, I think I'm clear to pivot over to Jack to talk about the book that he's got queued up for us.
Yeah, so this book was released pretty much exactly the time we record our previous episode, I think. Mm-hmm. But I didn't see it until after it. So it's called Breakout, How Atari 8-Bit Computers Defined a Generation. It's basically all about the Atari 800 and 400. And It is written by a guy named Jamie Landino, who apparently he runs a site called Extreme Tech and has worked at PC Mag and stuff like this. I've not read the book. I plan to buy it. I'm looking to find before I buy it. I remember I saw somewhere, and I'll add to the show notes if I can find it, I saw somewhere an offer to buy the print book and the Kindle book for like just an additional $3 over the print book price. But otherwise, you can buy either one of these. Like the paperback is $17 and the Kindle one is just about $19. I never understand, by the way, why Kindle books are more expensive than print books.
Huh.
It doesn't, I don't get it. This is not the only one. There are a lot of these like this, but
I wonder if it's a Swedish thing, because I'm not seeing that. For me, the Kindle is $14.99 and the paperback is $17.33.
Wow.
So.
Really? That's fascinating.
Interesting story.
Yeah, for me, the Kindle is $18.74.
Huh. Weird. Also, an oddly specific price.
Yeah. Okay. Well, anyway, I assume it's some tax.
Yeah.
They don't want people reading, for God's sake. Tax those words.
Maybe the Kindle editions fade in Sweden. They got to use stronger ink on the electronic version.
Yeah.
That's it. No, but anyway, so this is supposed to be about the sort of the history of the machines and also covering some of the games and some of what people are doing, people like our listeners are doing in modern days with modding hardware and extending things and creating new stuff. So, looks interesting. Looks like a good read for people interested in this sort of thing.
Yeah, looks
neat.
Looks pretty cool. I actually bought that yesterday, so I haven't read it.
Okay, but, good.
Yeah, I'm curious. I mean, the author isn't someone I know by name, but then I'm not that deep into the Atari world either. So there are many people I don't know the name of.
Yeah, I don't know him by name either. But
maybe you could come back at some point with a book report.
Yeah, definitely, I will do that.
Excellent. Well, so we were talking about cleaning our retro collection, but it sounds like Michael wants to talk about shrinking our retro collection.
Or maybe these went in the dishwasher and it was the too hot cycle and they shrank.
Right.
Don't put that in the dryer.
No. Came across this wonderful Etsy site, Rabbit Engineering. So if you've ever had concerns about how much space your retro computer collection is taking up, maybe you could do it in a miniature. And what I like about this site here is that there are currently 70 items that you can purchase, and the prices are not unreasonable. They are it's small, so you know literally you could misplace your entire collection. But I strongly suggest that our readers pop over and have a look at this website. 11 different Commodore machines, and you've got Nintendo machines, your Sinclair Mini machines. Some historic machines. There's Apples. I'm upset that there's no Apple IIc, my favorite computer of all time. But I can let that slide. I just love the MSI, the 8800 Altair. It's just amazing. And just to maintain the Apollo mission for the Retro Computing Roundtable, you too can buy a mini Apollo DSKY module.
Cool.
I don't think it works, but boy, it looks great.
Very nice.
Boy, these things are so cute. I love that little mini Atari 800. Oh my gosh, that's cute.
Yeah, no, I'm pretty sure that I've seen some of these before. It's possible that we linked to some version of this site before, but I did not understand.
Oh, if we have, it deserves to be linked to again.
Yeah, well, the variety here is just amazing. I mean, like, there's a Philips video pack you can get. You can get a HP 85, a Jupiter Ace. You know, I mean, like, it's really just amazing. There's an SX64.
Yeah, I would never thought you could get a Nintendo GameCube, but there it is.
Mm. Oh, and you can get I'm pretty sure I feel like I've seen this War Games set before, which is like a keyboard, a monitor, an MSI drive, a speaker, and a little like modem coupler, but it's listed as being, I don't know what the shipping is, but it's $30. I mean, I don't understand how it's that cheap. I need to buy this like right now. yeah, they're really not expensive at all, and they're beautiful. I mean, they It's conceivable that if you're like very close to them, you wouldn't think it's a real thing, but they look great in these pictures, and they're very small.
Yeah.
This tiny little Commodore PET 2001N, it looks just like mine. I should get it and stick it next to, or better yet, I should actually, at night, I should replace my Commodore PET with this and then see if the kids notice when they come downstairs.
Dad, I'm huge.
But they, it might not be totally, you know, scaled down, but it has the essence of the of each of those machines. It's just the way that it's done in these pictures here, and I'm so glad there's coins put there for reference. But yes, you can see the 3D printing artifacts left on it, but you know, you sit them up on a shelf, and I just think they would just look great. And yes, I would love to drop by and see your kids' expression when they see the dad shrunk the pet.
Oh, very cool. Well, that's a great find, Michael. And I'm thinking maybe you've cost me some money with that. But but you guys are right. The prices are completely reasonable for these.
Until you sort of want to buy all 70 of them. But
yeah, it's exactly what I was thinking.
Exactly.
It would be easy to spend $300 on this.
Yeah, piggy bank is blown. Okay, so egg chasing, you know, it's a new Olympic sport.
Or
is it?
We're coming up on Easter, right? So
true. What have you got to tell us about this, Paul?
Okay, so this is a post on edfries.wordpress.com, posted by, and it could be Freeze. I don't know how you pronounce his name, but I will say Ed Fries. And then I won't need to say it anymore. Ed posted this on March 22nd. It's called Chasing the First Arcade Easter Egg. So he was doing an interview with an engineer who worked in the arcade industry, you know, a long time ago. And Ron Milner is the guy's name. And he was an engineer and an inventor at Atari's secret think tank in the mountains from 1973 to 1985. And Ed was doing this interview with Ron Milner, and Ron asked, did you ever get a Starship 1 game, which is, you know, old arcade game? And, you know, so Ed said, yeah, I know it. I'd love to have one. Don't actually have one. And Ron said that there were a couple of you know, talked a little bit about the designing of that, and said that he thought maybe it was one of the first games that had a backdoor in it. And upon further exploration, it turned out that that if you did a certain thing, then, according to Ron, you could get the thing to say, hi, Ron, and give you 10 free games. And so there's kind of woven into this story is a discussion of, like, what was the first Easter egg? I think we probably even talked about this at some point in the past as a host topic, you know, like Easter eggs and games. But so this, you know, there was the Atari 2600 adventure game had, you know, little secrets in it. And there was apparently something in Video Whiz Ball for the Fairchild Channel F in 1978. But this at least had a possible, you know, claim to having the first Easter egg. And so there are a couple different things that Ed here was trying to do. One was to confirm the release date, which turns out to be, you know, surprisingly difficult, even as recent as 1970-something. But so he kind of goes through the detail of, like, how can we figure out, is this 1976, 1977? So he narrows that down. He tries to track down an original machine, and meanwhile plays around in the code in MAME, actually finds the text, hi, Ron, in there. You know, so he sort of details that, starts looking at the schematics to try to figure out, all right, what could trigger, this is all in 6502 code, so he's, you know, goes through trying to trace through what it would that would trigger the hi, Ron message. You have to hold down two things while putting in a coin, and then quickly release them and hit something else. So it's like this weird dance you have to do, it's quite amazing. So he, after some time, managed to get MAME to show him the message, so the message is actually there, and then he actually also got a machine itself delivered. And so, anyway, I could keep talking actually for probably the rest of the time that we have to record, because this article is very involved in like all the things he had to do and all the like detective steps he went through to try to get, you know, like the machine working and the, you know, like what he had to do to actually get the Easter egg to come up. Anyway, it's a super interesting read. It's surprisingly detailed. So definitely take a look at this. It's even if you don't care what the first Easter egg was.
Well, I think the neat part about this and activities like it is the investigative journalism that goes on with this. I mean, like you mentioned, they're digging for details, and even though it was as recently as the 70s, the details can be a little hard to come by, but I'll guarantee that 40, 50 years down the line, they would be a lot harder to come by. And like we've mentioned many times on the podcast, now's the time to be trying to chronicle these things, because you can still get some first-order sources for stuff like this. So, very cool. I'll have to give this a read. I love this kind of stuff. All right. Well, I'm going to talk real quick about the Vintage Computer Festival East, which I believe is underway right now as we speak.
So, in your past, and, dear listeners. But
yes, in your past, but in our current present, the VCF East is underway, and it looks like it was poised to be a great show. I saw a couple of pictures about the TRS-80 exhibit that they had there. It looked like basically all the TRS-80s. And there was one picture of a young lad standing there typing something at a Model 16, and the caption posed the question, are we, you know, at the dawn of a new generation of Model 16 fans? And I don't know. Maybe a small population of them, certainly. Also, the Commodore exhibit there was poised to be pretty cool as well, including the somewhat unobtainium Commodore 65. A few people in the Commodore world have them, but they're very rare. There's one on exhibit there. And if you want to see some of the Commodore esoterica that they were going to take to the show, there's a YouTube video on that from The Guru Meditation, a Commodore-oriented YouTube channel, Amiga stuff, as you might guess from their moniker. And we'll have a link to that up in the show notes. Some interesting stuff. And with that, I'll hand it over to Michael.
Oh, just hot off the presses is Sharp 80, a TRS-80 Model 3 emulator for Windows. And how do I know it's hot off the presses? Well, I was having a look at it in GitHub, and the last update was 13 hours ago. So what I like about this, it is a complete package. So not only is an emulator being provided, it comes with a bundle of disks, images, so you have the OS and some games and some other packages. So you can get up and running straight away. So whether you're a Model 3 aficionado or not, you can at least get everything going and see how it goes. It's what I like. It's faithful Z80 CPU emulation, including undocumented opcodes, and passes all the opcode tests that are available. So my hallmark of a great emulator is that covers the bugs, the undocumented features, and would also hopefully fail in exactly the same way as the real machine. Sometimes authors sort of put edits in to on the save, on the fail side of things, but I do like an emulator that all the undocumented bits and pieces are also emulated. So comes with a built-in Z80 assembler and disassembler, allows you to do entire state saves with snapshots. So it is a good emulator. I've had a bit of a look. I haven't got any of my Windows machines up and running, so I'm going to put this one for further investigation later on. But I'm glad to see that there is another emulator coming out into the community.
Mm-hmm. I'll be excited to give this one a try, too. I really enjoyed programming on the TRS-80. I felt like the disk basic version for the TRS-80 was one of the best that I'd encountered back in the 70s and 80s, and even made a little bit of money writing a program in BASIC for a business as my first consulting job on the TRS-80. And we'll love to take a look at this emulator. It's nice when everything is prepackaged and you can just take it out and run it, as opposed to taking 10 minutes to download the emulator, but then multiple hours trying to figure out how to get everything to work.
Yeah. Yeah. Some of that being trying to find the ROMs and, you know, battling with your conscience about that.
Right.
But
well, it's also, you know, the getting the disk images and getting disk images in the right format and just
right
struggling along there. So it's quite a well laid out website for the screenshots that are there, the commands, so your keyboard layout. It's quite good there as a command reference, and the key mappings. It's very good at times to actually have the key mappings easily available, because you know, we are talking about machines that weren't quite standard keyboards that we have here these days. So it's sometimes I forget my key press combinations for various emulators.
Mm-hmm. And you're saying it has those like on a quick reference?
Well, yeah, just here on the web page, there's a keyboard layout so that it just shows you the break and the clear.
Perfect.
Yeah, I attempted to try to get this going briefly. It wasn't actually all that brief, but of course I'm allergic to Windows, and I have nothing that runs Windows, and so I played around a little bit with like attempting to get this to run in Wine, but this requires Vista, which Wine is not capable of doing, and in fact I don't even have a copy of Vista.
Vista or higher, but yeah.
Well, yeah, I don't have a copy of anything that is Vista or higher. I have some XP, but and I guess apparently Windows Vista can emulate Windows XP, but not the other way around. So yeah, I mean, I am looking forward to trying this. I wonder how deeply it relies on the Vista things. You know, like I wonder if there is a way to compile this in such a way that it would run under Wine, because I'm not quite sure that I'm ready to dedicate a Windows install to this, but it does look really nice. And so in the process, I tried seeing what other emulators are out there, and I tried out this SDL TRS. I'm not sure if that is the most. I don't know what people use most often, but this seems like it's a relatively recent, relatively compatible cross platforms option. This is the one that was being used in that CP500 machine. And it's written by the same person who did Atari 800 Mac X, and it looks the same. I mean, you know, you can tell that it's basically just the same underlying code. It didn't work particularly well when I tried to get it to run. SDL TRS didn't work all that well when I was trying to get it to emulate a 4P, but that's as far as I got, really. You know, like I got it to a screen that wasn't updating quite right, but it did at least boot into a DOS. but yeah, I would kind of like to. This is a world that I'd kind of like to get into a little bit more than I am now. I mean, like I don't have much hardware. I have a color computer, and then I have a 4P. And you know, they're different animals anyway. But I would kind of like to get sort of more familiar with the TRS-80 stuff. So this is the way emulators is the way for me to start, I think.
Hmm. Yeah, I'll be firing up my Windows 7 machine for this one, so that gets me past the Vista or later. But yeah.
Okay, so 7's after Vista.
I believe that's how Microsoft counts.
Yeah, and when they jumped to 10 somewhere in there, right? There's no 9.
Yeah. There's no 9.
Well, anyway, whatever. anyway, it's cool. It's cool that this. I was glad to see that this. Exists and is a sort of like undercurrent development. So
awesome. Yeah, I'll load that up. I'm running Windows. It's my native OS, and it is Windows 10. And not only was there not a Windows 9, but if you believe Microsoft, there maybe won't be a Windows 11 either, in that they want to do incremental upgrades from this point forward and not have gigantic platform upgrades, which is a common theme in the software industry at the moment, having revisions and incrementing over time as opposed to giant forklifts of operating systems or applications. So we'll see. So I'll just mention before we get into the next segments of our show, the upcoming show roundup, I'll just mention the next three things that are coming up on the horizon. There's the 26th annual Last Chicago Cocoa Fest. That's going to be held April 22nd and 23rd in Lombard, Illinois. So that's just a handful of weeks away. Also, VCF Southeast 5.0 will be on April 29th and 30th, the next week. And that's in Roswell, Georgia. And then VCF Europa will also be April 29th to May 1st. And that's in Munich, Germany. And we've got links in the show notes for all of those. So stay tuned. And if you're near one of those, then go do some face-to-face retrocomputing. And before we move forward, a word from a company that might have been our sponsor had this podcast been in the 80s.
In these modern times, the person who goes to work may not have far to go. But at the Hat of the Month Club, the boss better keep moving. To keep the books, organize the files, write the letters, check out the inventory, find time to create, and still keep on top of things. Yet even a thriving business can reach a point of diminishing returns. A good time to learn about the IBM personal computer. With this tool for modern times, a person can quickly master such jobs as accounting or word processing. Even use the IBM personal computer to forecast growth. All helping the business person at home to wear many hats, while selling even more. And that can be a feather in anyone's cap. The IBM personal computer. Try one on at a store near you.
And we're back. And we're wondering how we can spend some of that money we made from our sponsor. And my idea, which, to be honest, isn't my idea at all. It's Paul's idea, which I'm stealing completely indiscriminately here. But I love it. We were talking about miniatures before. Let's talk about a miniature PC. This is episode 150, so we should talk about none other than the IBM 5150, which was the original IBM PC. And if you look at this little miniature of the 5150 PC, it's just gorgeous. And in case you were wondering what it is carefully labeled PC, just so that you don't get it confused.
In fact, I think that's the name. It's like P-E-E-C-E-E.
Yes. So not only is this a miniature, like some of the rest that we talked about, but it's also a desk clock. It's got a little built-in clock, which is just so itty-bitty cute. And it is NIB, which I believe means new in box. That's what the kids are saying these days. So the price here is $37.50 on eBay. And if you act quick, you might be able to get one because there's three available. And, you know, this is helpful if you're a retro computer enthusiast and you want to know what time it is. Paul, since you threw this in, did you have anything else you wanted to say about this?
Oh, only just that I actually got one of these. It arrived in the past week, so I got one some time ago. This is a different auction listing, but apparently this seller just had a bunch of these. But it's really, I mean, it looks, you know, looks like it's in the picture. It's really, the level of accuracy is actually quite high, except for the little PC, like this. There are little silver stickers that say PC that look a little dumb, but the actual unit looks great. I mean, so I haven't actually put it together yet. I've just looked at it in the box, but it is, you know, as originally produced, as far as I can tell. Not that I knew of, this is Advanced Micro Technology Inc. that have made this. I have no idea. But anyway, so I'm looking forward to putting it together, but it definitely looks great. So, and it has little holes for putting your pencils and stuff in.
I like that it has a very realistic looking power switch on the right side.
Yeah.
Have you seen that in one of the pictures? It looks like I remember some big gold PC boxes with big old switches on the back.
Yeah, this,
the big red switch, or the BRS, as we abbreviated it back in the day. Yeah, gorgeous. Very nice. Well, I wouldn't mind having one of those. That's a neat looking little clock. And, you know, there's other ways to spend money, too. For instance, other things on eBay. So, Jack, why don't you lead us off? What have you got for us on your eBay picks?
I have a Sun SparkStation 5, which in the 90s, I loved these things. These were great. This seems to be in good working condition. They have photographs of the machine inside and out and of a screenshots of it hooked up to a monitor, working, running, all sorts of things. Like, it's got a hard drive and it's got stuff on it. It seems to be quite okay and usable. And it's for just under 65 British pounds, which is pretty cheap, I think, for this. If anyone has not seen one of these, they are quite big. They're like, I don't know. It's you know, 90s style workstation. It's a big honking thing. But
I was going to ask, did the Spark 5 have the same footprint as the Spark Station 10?
I don't remember. I think the Spark 5 and the Spark 20 were introduced at the same time, I think. So I think they have the same sort of design, roughly. I'm not sure. I don't remember if the 10, I think the 10 might have been slightly earlier. I don't remember.
Yeah, the pizza box.
Yeah.
Spark 10s.
Okay. But so, yes, this is similar pizza box sort of thing. Like similar size to the Next slabs and that sort of thing as well.
But deep dish pizza box.
Deep dish pizza box.
Yes.
No, Chicago
style.
Wimpy
thin crust stuff.
So anyway, this is up for another 5 days, it looks like, on eBay, which, of course, is less in listener time. But pretty cheap right now, I think. It is, I guess it's in the UK, so I'm not sure what the shipping story is to other parts of the world. But if you're looking for a Spark Station, here you go.
Cool.
Yeah, I love those old boxes. I love the Spark 10s. That's the first real beefy Unix machine that I worked on. And I think you're right that the 5s and 20s were after and were even a little beefier. Still, by today's standards, pretty modest. It looked like it had a 75 megahertz processor on it. But, man, I'll tell you, they were pretty speedy little workstations back then.
Yep. Back in the day, these were a thing to have.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't have any real experience with almost any workstations of this sort, apart from Next. I mean, like, it sort of looks to me like a Next when starting, you know, but that's just because they all look like workstations.
Right.
Well, I don't remember if Next used this, but a few of the workstations did use the same kind of graphical interface. It seems like a few of the manufacturers got together and used what they called the common desktop environment, or the CDE. Mm-hmm. So if you looked at an HP or a Sun, or there were one or two others, and I mean, these are just waking up some old brain cells, but they had a common look under the X Windows operating system, or display system, right. I should say.
Yeah, Next did not really have that because they had their own display, and
right.
I mean, X Windows was available, but it was not really a part of the core thing, core experience, sort of. But what I remember using these machines mostly for was actually for running NextStep or OpenStep, because back in the day, Next had ported their OS. I mean, they started on 68000. They ported it to Intel, to Spark, to HP's PA RISC platform. And I think that, I remember it was rumored that they ported it elsewhere too. But anyway, those are the ones that they released. So I remember we had some of these where I was working, and they ran circles around the Next hardware, obviously, and even around the available Intel hardware at the time. I mean, these were super fast, powerful machines. Mm-hmm. So they were great to work on.
And not cheap.
No, not cheap.
Yeah.
They were not cheap at all.
So don't spill milk on those.
Don't, no.
Not a good idea. So, Michael, it looks like you've got some things in here to enhance our apparel.
Yes. Yes. I've got a selection of different pins and also some cautionary tale. I like collecting lapel pins or tie tacks or anything along those lines for my computers. Unfortunately, these days, there's quite a lot of reproduction work, and you just have to be careful. But sometimes, you know, the reproduction ones are actually done quite well. So I've got one here for, it says, Atari Sign Retro Vintage Lapel Pin Badge Gift. So I think they're trying to hit those search keys. But this is actually done by a pin manufacturer in the UK. It seems to be quite well done. So if you're after something for your retro computer, so in this case here, if you're an Atari fan, you can get something for a very cheap price, only $6.87 for myself and $4.80 postage to Australia. So, it's quite a reasonable price as long as you're aware that it's not the genuine retro article. And of course, there's quite a lot of vintage pin apparel out there. So another one I've got here, they've said it's a rainbow Macintosh computer lapel tie pin tack souvenir. It's in fair condition, there seems to be quite a lot of different Apple pins available. Apple IIs, IIcs, just the generic six color Lisa ones. And a various range of different Macintosh ones are also out there. So this one does look to be the real article.
You can tell by how beat up it is.
Yes. Yeah. Unfortunately, that is an indicator. So again, there's I've never had any problems sort of like tracking down an Apple six color pin. Just the different types that are there. Also in the reproduction one. The next one I've got here is it's a combination set. So if you're, say, looking for something just to have a little bit of variety, this is a Commodore, a ZX Spectrum, and Nintendo 64. That's an interesting combination of pins. But again, quite reasonably priced. So if you're just looking for something to wear to that next retro event, you can wear your logos proud. And I just thought I'd save this one for last. I just love finding interesting little pieces of history. So this one is a UNIVAC employee's pin button, and it says UNIVAC begins with you. So that's an auction. So if you're after something a little bit different, this might be the one for you.
Nice.
Very clever. So I guess there's no I in team sort of thing. Even find it in the 60s.
Yeah. Everything old is new again.
But yeah, with this very cool. With this pin, it pretty much all it has is history. It's otherwise not super elegant.
But, no.
So you do not really want a reproduction of this, I don't think.
No, I think this one, the genuine article, is quite sufficient.
Well, I guess I'll go next before I turn it over to Paul. And what looks like we might have a selection, including some trainer boards this time around. Mine is for a North Star Horizon. I've always loved the look of this computer. And for the life of me, I can't understand why. It's just a wooden lid with a square, a rectangular box, and North Star Horizon badge on the front, and some vertically mounted floppy disk drives. Maybe it's the simplicity of it that I like. And I did have the opportunity, like many of the systems we talk about here, to work with one of these way back when. And I'm not sure that they're going to get what they're asking in this auction. They're looking for a starting bid of $3,000. Now, that might be a little rich. The North Star Horizon is kind of a contemporary with the other S-100 systems that you might be more familiar with, like the IMSI and the Altair that we mentioned before. But I don't think it's as well known outside of the enthusiast community, and I don't know if it's rare enough to justify a $3,000 starting bid, but it is in working condition. The wood top and sides that I mentioned are in decent shape. It's one of the things that could happen with one of these North Stars is that the wood gets beat up over time. And since these things are old, you know, opportunity for it to get beat up. And I'm sure that these were probably also used double as like a drink holder,
right.
Things like that back in the day. So it's nice that this one is working and that they show pictures of it working and they show pictures of the inside. The inside of this guy looks pretty pristine. The circuit boards don't look all dusty. In fact, they look pretty nice, and so do the disk drives. So, I don't know. Maybe they'll get $3,000. Maybe I'm underestimating this, but I really do like this auction. Did you guys have a chance to take a look at this?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. Though I must, I'm thinking that maybe the asking price is to go towards finishing lining out the room and fixing up all the walls. But
it just looks like it's in an unfinished room.
Yeah.
But, painter's tape over everything and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm, I don't know if my pockets could quite reach down for even just the 3,000 starting, the 5,000 if you wanted to buy it now to just to like save all the hassles of going through an auction. But yeah, it's I've always liked those machines, and yeah, I have to agree with Earl that you know, the problem with those cases, they do tend to get a little bit of beat up and wear on the edges. This one's in like fair to good condition, but yeah, the insides look beautiful.
Yeah, I'd agree with the fair to good condition. If it was in more of a brand new condition, then maybe they might achieve that starting bid, but in any event, it's a thing of beauty to look at, so I thought I'd throw it into the auction list here, if nothing else, just people could take a look at the photographs mm-hmm. on that one.
So yeah, this Horizon auction actually has a bit of a history. So an ancestor of this auction was actually in the episode 146 picks, and at that point... it was opening at a starting bid of $2,000, and it got four bids from the same person. So someone who really, really, really wanted to get it, apparently. But then I guess didn't, because then it had been... So I think probably at that point, the expectation was set that, you know, this is worth whatever that would end up being, like at least $2,015 or something. So then it got relisted at $4,000. A few times, and then at $3,250, and then at $3,000, and now we've landed at the starting bid $3,000 buy it now price of $5,000. So I suspect that this will continue to be available to look at in the future.
I see. Very interesting. Thanks for that history, Paul. I know you keep an eye on eBay, especially on some of these rarities. So that's awesome. Well, yeah, we'll see as it crawls down toward what might be a bid that will make somebody bite.
It really does seem like it would be a cool thing to have. I mean, like, if this is another one of those things that I would not turn away if it appeared, but I'm, you know, I haven't been quite chasing it down with that many dollars in hand, but I would like to have one, and they do look wonderful.
Yes. And you know, for some reason, I might even take one over an Altair or an IMSI. I'm not sure why. I mean, I like the blinking lights and the flippy buttons, but the North Star Horizon just always had a down-to-business feel to mm-hmm. me. Anyway. Okay, Paul, you're up.
Okay, so I have a few oddities. The first one that I wanted to mention is it's a vinyl single. That's a 45. by a musician I don't know, but a Canadian, apparently, Bill Deal. And this is, it's two things. One is called Nothing But Love, and the other side is Bent Brandenburg. And what's interesting about these is that these were produced on, basically sequenced, I guess, and possibly some other stuff, with an Apple IIe. So.
So the real deal.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Yeah, points for the pun.
Sorry.
But yeah, anyway, so I mean, I have no idea if it's any good. I have a pretty hard time actually tracking down any information about this musician, although the one thing that I did track down seemed to suggest that he was well known. So it's well known, but not well documented online. And it's not in perfect shape. There's a bit of a tear in the you know, the sleeve that it comes in, and it appears that it doesn't have anything but a sleeve. But still, it's kind of interesting. So, and its starting bid is $6. So I mean, it's not going for much, but I thought it was kind of funny to see. No disrespect to Bill Deal, I'm sure his music is wonderful, but I just hadn't heard it before. Okay, so there were a couple. I pick these occasionally when I see them, but there are a couple of Heathkit 3400 trainer things that came up, and so one of them's already sold, so I will point you to it, but you will not be able to buy it. The first is a ETW 3400A microcomputer trainer, and so there's a half a dozen or more prior episodes of RCR where I've picked these things. They're 6800 based, just little microcomputer trainers. They have a keypad. They have six, you know, whatever they are, nine segment displays, eight segment displays, however many segments there are. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Anyway, it's capable of saying CPU up when you turn it on, and this one successfully does. Part of what I wanted to just note about this is I looked at this. When I saw it listed, I thought, ETW, what is it? And like, I know this is an ET3400, you know, why does it say ETW? And from what I could gather, there's one basic thing, and you could buy it from Heathkit and you could build it, but you could also buy them pre-wired. And I think the ones that are built for you are the ETWs. And the ones that you assemble yourself and then, you know, pass on to your heirs to sell on eBay are ET3400. So that's, this picture actually, there's a picture of the label. It says ETW3400A. So if you're, you know, looking on the eBay listings and you see ETW, you might even prefer that because that means it wasn't just someone's home assembly, you know, with cracked solder joints and so forth. And also the 3400A, I think, has to do with how many sort of slots there are for RAM chips. So this 3400A has two RAM sockets in the upper left corner, and I think the 3400 non-A had four. Anyway, a lot of little detail in this, but and if you have a 3400, I have a couple of these. That I've managed to do like a little tiny bit of programming by copying basically out the program from the manual. And it's pretty cool. I mean, it's just basically like an experimenting board. So if you have one, you can also get an I/O accessory, which is basically, it provides for more memory. And I think it has a way to like load and save tape. This is the ETA 3400. So the numbering scheme takes a lot of, you have to get used to it because everything is ET something 3400. And, the ETA 3400 is an accessory that you can plug into your, ET or ETW 3400. And these are not super, super rare, but they're pretty rare. They don't come up very often. So this one was $90, buy it now. And it was bought within the last 24 hours since I put it in here. So I have one, but it does not yet work. So that's, I've discovered that when I plug it into, I've probably said this before, but when I plug it into an ET3400, the 3400, the ET3400 worked. You know, it went to CPU up before I plug it in, and when I plug it in, it just flips out. So there's something wrong.
But mm.
Any of you have one of these or played with one?
No and no, but they definitely look like something I'd be interested in pursuing.
It seems like it's a pretty cool way to, if you wanted to learn 6800 assembly in a kind of low stakes way, this seems like a good way to do it.
Yeah, these look fun. I think the other thing is that didn't we at some point on the RCR talk about some new trainer boards that are being developed like modern day but with the old chips? Mm-hmm. Like there was a 6502 and I think a 6809. And so it'd kind of be the question of, do you want to poke around with the microprocessor using a trainer board from back in the day, which these look really cool. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I might be motivated to go in that direction. Or if it's wanting to poke around with the processor, but you want hardware that you know is new and likely works, right, then I think there are some modern choices as well. I haven't looked those up on eBay recently, but I know they were out there.
Yeah, I can picture them. If I can locate some of those auctions. Some seller has a number of them that are with different microprocessors, and they're not super expensive and they are modern. And I know we've had listed them, you know, some recent time. So I can see in my mind the photos. It'd be fun to get one of those too, but there's a sense in which I feel like my motivation is lower somehow for that. Cause if I'm going to do that, I almost want to just use an emulator.
Mm-hmm.
But, okay, let's see. What other things are interesting here? So I linked in the show notes to a new old stock TRS-80 Model 16 128K memory board. It is in its box, and in fact, actually, so it's from, I don't know how this seller acquired it, but it is sealed from Radio Shack National Parts. So apparently this is unused stock. So if you have, and nobody listening does, maybe one person listening has a TRS-80 Model 16, you can get a 128K memory board in its box. So one was opened to show it. Apparently there are four available, but the other ones are sealed. And it's pretty cool that this exists. And if you go to the seller's other items, there are a bunch of this sort of thing, you know, like various stuff, various in-box stuff and parts for particularly Model 16s. But so, weird.
Yeah, I just love things like this just to remind me of how much money we had to spend to buy these things new back then. It's got sold the stock item $599, sort of 128K.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it'd be pretty cool, except I don't have and probably will never have a Model 16. So I think those are frighteningly rare, actually, even more rare than the Model 2, I suspect. Okay, let me just sort of quickly mention this. So this auction has appeared a couple times. This is probably the second time. I don't think we mentioned it here, but there's a PowerBook, a JLPGA PowerBook. I think it's a PowerBook 170, maybe. That was made specifically for this Japanese LPGA golf tournament in whatever this would have been, like 1992 or something. And it's apart from just it's the coloring of the plastic that makes this one interesting. So I don't know if I said this, but there are only 500 of these made about, and it's a blue PowerBook with other primary colors kind of like in the pieces of it. So the hinge, parts of the hinge are yellow, and it's got I think that must be the battery door or something is red. It looks like it's built of Lego.
It does. It does have that look.
Yeah, Lego coloring.
Oh, nice. And yeah, little green green feet behind it to keep it at a typing angle, and a green hinge, but a gray keyboard. So they look pretty cool. They are, super rare and therefore super expensive and super collectible. I do not have one and do not actually really intend to have one. This is going for $74.94. Buy it now. At the moment, and
that's dollars, not dollars and cents.
Yes, $7,494.00. This is at least the second listing that I've seen of this. And what's remarkable about this one, I have seen other ones listed, but what's the thing that jumps out at me about this is that it has this bag, and it has it has the same colors on a carrying case bag, and the bag has an Apple insignia on it, which I believe is real. I mean, it looks real enough, and I have never seen that bag before. So the thing is rare, but I think the bag that it came in is extra rare. So.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, so the colors of Benetton, it's a great pairing there. There are people out there that look for those there, but that's the first time I've seen the bag in such good condition.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the bag looks phenomenal.
And
looks
going back on the cleaning side of things, doing that to the computer, that saves a lot of issues of whether do I retrobrite or not.
Yeah, well, although these were they were gray initially, so
yeah.
The gray, you can see yellowing in it.
Mm.
Like, I mean, I have duos that look kind of green, almost. Mm.
And yet again, it's always the space key that starts going a different shade. So
yeah.
Most sweat and oils and things from the skin on it as well, and I'm sure they must use a different plastic for the because of the size of the actual key itself. But yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So the moral of the story is don't press the space bar.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you have to go back and tell your, like, you know, whatever 25 years ago self.
Mm. But,
okay. Anyway, another thing that showed up in my random collection of things that showed up is a Microsoft Adventure. Packet from IBM. So this is, this was, you know, right in the, does it say? I don't know when, I'm not sure actually when it was published, but this is like one of the first couple of things that came out with the, you know, original 5150. This is in their entertainment series. I don't know what else was in their entertainment series, but it's a little gray binder. Manual that says Microsoft Adventure with a big, you know, picture of a dragon of some sort, and the disc that says, you know, the regular sort of IBM format, you know, 617-2314, Microsoft Adventure, copy protected. That's a nice little, oh yeah, June 1981. That's a, so it's a nice artifact. And actually, June 19, when did the PC come out? I thought it was after that, but anyway. Is this a familiar thing?
I've seen it a long time ago. But I just love how the styling, the slipcase would just sort of like slide right in there beside all the your business titles. So
Yeah, it's in. I mean, it's in a folder, but it's still it looks pretty official. Okay, yeah, IBM introduced August 12th, 1981. So this was ready a little bit before the PC was released, but still, it's in the right time. So, yeah, I have this Adventure folder. My disk's in a little slightly less good shape, but I haven't attempted to copy it because it says right on there I can't. But oh well. Anyway, this is actually going for fairly cheap. This is a one bid down so far, $30 on it. So we'll see if that holds. 6 days left. So okay. Then I will move on to the last thing. One last wooden computer. This is a Sol 20. And so this appeared like moments before we started recording. So I mashed this in there quickly too. 6 days, 21 hours left on this. There is a bid down. There wasn't when I put it in. But I assume people have seen the Sol 20 before, but it's a blue computer with like wooden sides in a kind of a wedge typewriter shape. Is it an S100 computer? I think it is. Do we know?
I don't know that answer. It definitely has S100 looking slots on it, but I don't know if it's S100.
This is embarrassing. I should know this, but they look great. I mean, they are a very pretty machine. You don't see them come up very often. And sometimes when you do see them, I think it's blue painted metal with brown wooden sides. And I think there's might actually be glass or some sort of like clear badging that goes right above the keyboard. Because I've seen that actually in worse shape. This looks quite nice. It is starting at a super cheap price. It doesn't actually have much in it, so I think probably you would want to add some cards to this. But the auction text speculates that it might have been just being used as a terminal. There's some kind of a little plug-in card that looks like it might be almost like a ROM personality card or something that you can put in here that is apparently not in there because something else is in its place. But anyway, it's worth taking a look at. It's in as good shape as I've ever seen one on eBay. So, Earl, do you have one?
I don't have a Sol 20, and I do really like the look of them. And I'm looking at one of the sites here. It sounds like it is an S100-based computer.
Okay. I don't think I have any such computers at the moment, and I'm a little frightened to even consider getting into them. But
the S100 systems, that can definitely pull you down the rabbit hole. I mean, there's still modern boards that are being made for that today in a retro fashion, mm-hmm. And there's you can still find boards on eBay. This last kick through eBay looking for my auction, I found some S100 boards out there, memory cards, and you can find a Z80 board. And bit by bit, you can put together a computer for yourself. And if you don't want to use an old linear power supply with the ginormous capacitors, you can go ahead and retrofit it with something a little bit more modern that'll give you the required voltages if you choose to go that way. Or you can, make the linear power supply work. They were big and bulky, but that's the way that they did it back then. So, I would tread lightly in terms of getting into the S100 world. In the garage right now, I've got a couple of S100 chassis with just the power supply and the card slots. And the chassis are in decent shape. Don't know if the power supplies work. Sometimes with those old gigantic capacitors, you want to give them a chance to reform when you're So in other words, you want a variable power put into them and let them reform as they come up. There's a whole science to it, and I don't know it.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I want to get into that. I might want to give it to somebody who would be better at the care and feeding.
Yeah, I feel much the same. Though it does remind me, actually, of something I was going to put in earlier. But so this is April 2nd. Yesterday was April 1st, and the time when everybody makes jokes and things like that. And generally annoying holiday, although occasionally there are some funny things. But I was thinking that maybe next year I can propose this as a retro computing accessory, which would be like a little USB thing you plug in while you're running your emulator that has on it a capacitor to blow, so that you could fully emulate the experience by having it at some random point, blow a capacitor plugged into your machine. So
yeah, there you go. Let out the smoke.
Yeah. I have no more auctions left. And of course, time's ticking on. But
all right. Well, I'll take us into the closing discussions, for which I have nothing to add this week. But I will go around the table here. Jack, why don't you lead us off? Help us land this plane.
Well, I just want to say I had one fun thing that I did. As recently as today, I installed a composite video mod in this old Atari 2600. So these machines, like several video game systems from the 70s, all they have is an RF out. You plug it into your TV, tune to channel 2 or 3 or 4 or whatever. And with modern TVs, these tend to just be terrible. You always got a bad picture back in the day, but modern TVs are not meant to receive this kind of signal very well, and a lot of these devices just don't put out a strong enough signal. So my latest attempts to use this old Atari were pretty lousy in terms of what I could get on any of the TVs or monitors I had in the house. And so I found this thing. I picked it up off of eBay for $10. It's this package that it has three RCA connectors. You're going to drill holes, put them on the back of your machine to plug in composite out and audio out and stuff, and you solder together some bits and cut some bits off of your motherboard, off the board, the circuit board inside the machine. And I did it today, and I got a nice, crisp composite video out. Pretty amazing.
Excellent.
Cool. Congratulations.
I felt like I did something and didn't break it, and it was pretty cool.
Nice.
So,
it looks like this the same seller has also a pause mod that you can add so that you don't necessarily have to just like keep playing the 2600 through all life events.
Right. Yeah, I saw that as well. It seems that involves a separate chip. I wonder what it does. It does something. It'd be interesting to see. But I've not gone that far. I'm happy enough to have this working, so I can actually plug this into a modern TV and play some games and see how it goes.
Cool.
Nice. Well, Michael, what have you got for us on Parting Shots?
Well, I just thought I'd like to remind our listeners that the Retro Challenge is currently underway. Late entries will be accepted, but you still have to complete it by the end of April. So no extensions. But I think we've got about 24 entries so far. So we'll include a link to the website. And if you're not going to enter, then at least pop over to the Retro Challenge website and check out this round's contestants and cheer on for your favorite.
Will do. And thanks for helping out with this, Michael. I love the Retro Challenge, and I'm happy that you're a part of that activity. It's so much fun twice a year to watch what people are doing.
Yeah, John and I just want to keep it going, and whatever we can do, we just love doing it. So get in there and get your late entry, or at least when these guys start blogging and tweeting about what they're doing, give them some feedback. Let them know how you like what they're doing, and maybe slip them a few ideas. It's a great exercise, can't wait to give a halftime update.
Nice. And that'll be just about in time for the next RCR.
Funny about
that. So that'll be good timing. Yeah. All right, Paul, give us a finale here before the wheels fall off.
Well, not a whole lot has happened. Things are so busy. One sort of news event was that Kansas Fest has opened their registration. We've been talking about that. Can't let one episode go by without talking about it. But registration opened, and also with that came the somewhat surprising news that they are limited to 100 people. And I think that's probably not a problem. I don't think we weren't that close last year. I think it might have been something like 80. But it's still sort of interesting in a couple of ways, there might actually be, it might actually be that it fills up, and the limit actually has to do with the venue. There's just not, the presentation space isn't big enough to sort of safely hold more people than that. So if you were planning on going, they will probably announce if they're getting close to the end of space. But from what I understand, there was a pretty big rush right at the beginning because of that. So, Michael, you and I are both on it, right?
Yep. Yeah. I wasn't going to risk it, especially for the international travelers. I know that a lot of us like to try and get our itineraries all sorted out, and then we just finish it off with getting our registration. But this year, I suppose it's a slim chance that they could max out, I've done it in reverse. I've gone in, I've booked my registration, and now I'm going to sort out my itinerary. So, where am I going to travel to? What am I going to see on my way to Kansas? So, it makes for an interesting break, but it might have just been a cunning marketing ploy to get people to register quickly. That venue gets a little bit squeezy when everyone's in there, so I can understand that they've got building safety issues with the number of people down in the presentation space downstairs, but not my problem this year. I'll be there.
Yeah, I think, I mean, my guess is that the college itself just says, this is all you're allowed. So, but it's kind of a neat thing that, from what I understand, the at this one particular event, the population has been increasing year over year. And it could be that the hobby is, at least for the moment, relatively healthy, as everybody realizes that they preferred the past. So,
yeah.
Anyway, but yeah, so that was sort of on my mind, I guess, of late. I'm now registered and planning to go, and not sure if I'm gonna submit for a talk or anything. But and I'm still thinking about the retro challenge. I'm glad to know that the late entries are allowed. I'm not sure if I'll get in or not, but we'll see. That's it for me, though.
Cool. Well, and that's it for this show. You can, as always, find the show notes for RCR at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss this show and other great things at the Vintage Computer Federation forums. That's www.vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast. You can join our Facebook group. It's a lot of fun over there. We'll have that link up in the show notes. Or just go to Facebook and search for RCR Podcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We're a member of the Throwback Network. If you like retro, you're going to like the Throwback Network. You can find it at throwbacknetwork.net. And if you like this show, and if you haven't done it, please feel free to write a review for us on iTunes. It helps other people who are like-minded to find the show. That said, until next time,
Retro Compute.